Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be exploring a classroom on the air involving health. Normally, I would give the latest science from all over the world. But today, I'm going to address the needs of so many people who've contacted me in the past several months asking about one condition, Alzheimer's. So I'm taking on one condition for the first 20 minutes of our program, but it'll be a whole classroom. And if you were sitting across me in my office and you had a person in your family suffering from Alzheimer's, this would be the kind of insights that you would receive. So please take some notes. Then picking up yesterday's discussion on a new form of Orwellian doublespeak, I'm going to continue with my commentary, as well as Professor Henry Giroux, Rethinking Orwell's 1984 and Huxley's Brave New World in America, exploring how we've been living in an Orwellian existence for at least 30 years. And today it's simply manifesting in a way that people are willing to challenge it. But why weren't they challenging all the discriminatory practices, all of the overreach of all intelligence agencies during the Obama's 8 years? I see that both presidents, Obama and Trump, are equally culpable when it comes to making bad decisions, and I'll explore that in depth. Also, last evening, I was watching a debate on Australian television involving Sharia law, and there was a very articulate person who represented this Sharia perspective and stated that this other person, this other woman, did not understand what she was talking about. Because Sharia is not actually a dominant theme within Islam, it is more cultural, and she has to understand that if, for example, Saudi Arabia does not allow women to drive, it is the only Islamic country in the world that does not allow Islamic women to drive, and or Muslim women to drive. And that's cultural, and that's separate from Islam. So what we're going to do today is we're going to set aside a substantial part of the program to try to get a better, more reasoned, honest, and historically accurate understanding of Christianity at its best and worst, Judaism at its best and worst, and Islam at its best and worst, to try to take away a lot of the innuendo, misinformation, unnecessary bias towards any one of these three great religions. And we'll be joined by one of our scholars in residence, Richard Gale, who also graduated from theological seminary and school at University of Chicago and has spent his life traveling the world, understanding cultures and religions. We will also be listening today to part two of the false allegations of rape used to lynch an African refugee in Israel, as well as also used against Palestinians. And this is from an observant Jew who is a journalist living in Israel who is reporting on this. And after watching it several times, I believe he is making some very important, insightful arguments that we in the United States and nowhere in our media are we exposed to. Also, I don't know how much time we'll have for this, but I want to share an audio clip of how the left killed the anti-war movement. And once the home of the anti-war movement under Barack Obama, the left advocated a continuation of war and mass murder by using the political expediency of humanitarian intervention. Once again, Orwellian, we're coming to your country for peace, humanitarian, and democratic reasons. No, you're not. You came here for our resources. because you didn't like our political agendas. And so I will share that with you as well. Let's begin. We're going to talk in depth about Alzheimer's. Why? Because it is an epidemic in the United States, and it's about to become a pandemic. I had six close friends that I grew up with. One, Tom Croft, from the age of one. I knew these people my whole life. They were wonderful human beings. They've all passed. Most passed in their 50s. And they lived hard lives. They drank, they smoked, they ate a bad diet, they were highly stressed, they didn't exercise outside of high school or college, and hence it was not genetic that caused them to die, it was their habits. And no matter how much influence I tried to have, it did not work. They knew they could make better choices, but I must always respect their right to say no to that better choice, and I must respect their right to continue unhealthy lifestyle choices, even when I know what the outcome will be. Then I have another group of friends who are now in their 60s or 70s, and I'm seeing in every one of them loss of memory, dementia. In fact, one of my very close friends, one of the very first people I met when I came to New York, who's a very famous person, and a very gentle person, very talented. And I saw it 5 years ago, dementia. And I did everything I could at that time, intervening with him and his family. But no one wanted to take it seriously. And now he's got full-blown Alzheimer's. And therefore is. And they're not going to help him, and he's not able to help himself. So Alzheimer's to me is very personal. I've seen, not in my own family, because people didn't live long enough in my own family to suffer from it. But in others, yes. So it deserves attention, because we're all going to face that day when people we love, people we've grown up with, or family members start suffering from first memory loss. Where to put my keys? What was the name of that restaurant we ate at? I forgot the name of that that movie I saw last night. That's how it starts. But then it gets to the point, once you have a conversation three times in the same day, and it's the same identical conversation, that's dementia. Alzheimer's is the leading cause of senile dementia in this country. It's slow but progressive, and it wipes out many functions of the brain, especially memory. And the heartbreaking tragedy of Alzheimer's disease is that it steals the person by taking away who they are. According to the latest Alzheimer's disease facts and figures published by the Alzheimer's Association, 5.3 million Americans are living with the disease, two-thirds of whom are women. But in the very near future, since we have at least 100 million people over the age of 40, it's going to go up to about 14 to 15 million people. It's increasing death rates also. In fact, the number of Alzheimer's deaths increased by 71% in just the last 13 years. So once a person is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, then it's not long thereafter until they succumb. But before they do die, you can see the strangest behavior imaginable. A person brought a family member to be helped with Alzheimer's, and the person did not know where they at. They would make strange statements. They had to be watched 24/7 because they'll wander off. Then they don't remember where they were. And even loved ones, they don't recognize. And that's the heartbreaking part. Now, why? What causes Alzheimer's? There's many factors that contribute. The most common risk factors from my research would be hyperhomocysteinemia, or high homocysteine levels, which is significantly correlated with low levels of the nutrients folic acid and B6 and B12. Also, altered taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E, metabolism. The body's ability to metabolize taurine is essential. Now, it is a non-essential amino acid necessary for the proper development and maintenance of the central nervous system, which may contribute to the memory loss that is characterized by Alzheimer's when altered. Low levels of DHEA, that's an adrenal hormone that declines with age, but DHEA is also the mother hormone from which a lot of other hormones are manufactured. So when you're low in it, you're going to be low in those other essential hormones as well. Low levels of acetylcholine, serotonin, GABA, and dopamine, and norepinephrine, which are all key neurotransmitters, and then imbalances in your estrogen progesterone levels. Now, these can be contributed to by environmental risk factors, including exposure to neurotoxins, such as the mercury fillings in your mouth, the mercury in vaccines, the lead in the environment, pesticides, excess iron, any form of alcohol, free radical damage, aluminum exposure, and aluminum is in deodorants, in cookware, and in vaccines. So you have 100,000 man-made chemicals that we're exposed to in our environment, and none of them have been researched synergistically, meaning if one is not bad, does that become bad when it's used with four other chemicals? And more often than not, the answer is yes, and at very low dosages. We also have social risk factors as well. Factors such as lower levels of education, a lack of social contact, poor word fluency, emotional stress or poor stress coping mechanisms, and the lack of willingness to learn new information and face mental challenges. All of those have been implicated in the development and progression of symptoms of Alzheimer's. So here's a question for you. How often in life have you met someone after high school or college, after they're settled into their career, stop learning? They don't read. They don't challenge themselves. They don't learn to play a musical instrument. They don't learn new words. They don't learn new languages. All of that creates a risk. Then you have physical risk factors, and these could include just the aging process. You can have trauma, depression, reduced blood flow to the brain, a stroke, many strokes, olfactory deficits, gum disease, yes, markers of inflammation in your mouth or markers of inflammation in your blood can all lead to Alzheimer's. Now, generally, the presence of amyloid, that's A-M-Y-L-O-I-D, amyloid plaques, and neurofibrillary tangles are the only definitive way to make a positive diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. Now, progress is being made in using advanced imaging techniques and novel biomarkers to detect disease and dementia before they reach the moderate stages. Unfortunately, even the powerful imaging tools used by doctors today cannot reliably scan for these markers. Only a brain biopsy or an autopsy can provide positive confirmation that Alzheimer's disease is the cause of an individual's dementia. So early detection of Alzheimer's disease is extremely difficult. From my perspective, I look for loss of memory short-term. That's always a red flag. So you've got memory loss, especially forgetting names, objects, places, times, and dates, and an inability to recall recently learned information. Difficulty performing everyday tasks and forgetting to maintain personal hygiene. Problems with language and noticeable intellectual decline. Disorientation to time and place. Being late, not knowing that you had to do something, not realizing the time you took to do it, a tendency to wander from home or office, poor or decreased judgment, the inability to have abstract thinking, an inability to follow simple instructions or to stay focused on tasks, misplacing objects or putting things in unusual places, then thinking someone stole something from you when they didn't. Changes in mood or behavior, especially rapid, unwarranted changes in emotions. Changes in personality, exhibiting extreme confusion and suspicion and fear and dependency. And a loss of initiative and frequently depression. So all of these are part of it. Now, I do not support the traditional treatment because it doesn't work. But there are natural therapies that do. In fact, having worked with many people with Alzheimer's and dementia, even doing a study group, a clinical study on lifestyle and behavior modification, we were able to reverse Alzheimer's, reverse Parkinson's, reverse multiple sclerosis, and to stop and improve myasthenia gravis. So there's a whole lot that can be done, but it depends upon the stage that a person's at and how much they're willing to do. The very first thing I always suggest is you've got to create a healthy, clean, pollution-free environment, free of hazardous toxins, particularly heavy metals that can accumulate in the body. High levels of aluminum and mercury are found in the brain cells of Alzheimer's patients. So you have to limit your exposure to deodorants, antacids, cookware, and food additives that contain aluminum. And mercury is found in thermometers and thermostats and dental amalgams and vaccines. And is recommended to remove all silver fillings using holistic dental techniques from your mouth. Chelation therapy. Chelation is C-H-E-L-A-T-I-O-N, which uses certain amino acids to form strong ionic bonds with the toxic metals in your body, allowing them to be excreted from the system. And that's very useful. It generally takes, with Alzheimer's or dementia, between 80 to 140 treatments for to really clean the heavy metals out of the body. Installing the best water filtration system so that your drinking water is toxic-free. Also, I definitely recommend social activity. Engage yourself in community activities, because the more you engage with people and activities, the more healthy your brain becomes. And then exercise. Whether a person wants to or not, they've got to exercise. Exercise is one of the single most important things you can do, because we have learned that you can decrease the level of plaque-forming beta-amyloid protein fragments in their brains by exercising. So remaining physically active throughout your lifetime offers immediate benefits to both body and brain. And then memory skills and brain boosters. So in addition to an active body, it's important to have an active mind. A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine supports the theory that mentally demanding activities can help stave off dementia. So you need to engage in learning. Crossword puzzles are good. That's all important. Any form of mentally stimulating hobby and being willing to learn new information is always important. In fact, I suggest people who have family members or friends with Alzheimer's or dementia, go to my website, progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryNall.com, and read the articles every day. Maybe start with 2 or 3 articles, but then get to where you can read 10 or 20, and then tell someone, here's what I just read. And then, what does it mean to you? What did you learn from that? That will help. Very, very important. And then coping skills. If you or someone close to you has been diagnosed as being in the early stages of Alzheimer's or dementia, there's some strategies for coping with the symptoms of memory loss that may be the first hallmarks of the disease. And these coping strategies can help relieve the stress and tension that arises from memory problems. For example, establish a regular routine in familiar surroundings. Then make mental associations, such as using landmarks to help you find things. Then repeat names when you meet people. Then put important items, such as your keys, in the same place every time. And label or color code doors and exits to keep from getting disoriented. And draw a map for simple routines. Write down directions and make lists. Use a calendar and keep notes of important dates and financial matters. Set realistic goals. All of this is important. Then the diet, that's the most important. You've got to shift over to a plant-based diet, a Mediterranean diet, with proper supplements, meaning the more berries, blueberries, pomegranate, elderberries, elderberry concentrate, these are all important. All the berries, also the seeds, hemp seed, sesame seed, sunflower seed, pumpkin seed. These are all important. Chia seeds. All the different nuts into the diet or nut butters. Juicing. Start with one juice per day for the first month. Add a second juice per day, the second month, and a third juice a day, the third month, and a fourth juice a day for the fourth month. A, this will keep the person from eating junk food because it keeps them full. Secondly, the juices, if they're green juices, like celery and cucumber with green apple and lemon, chelate out toxic metals. So the more these juices you drink, the cleaner your body becomes. These are also flooding the body with antioxidants and anti-inflammatory properties. Remember, all this is due to inflammation, so you're turning off inflammation. There are certain supplements in addition to a well-balanced diet. Magnesium is well known for its calming properties in people with anxiety problems, but proper amounts of magnesium are generally lacking in the average diet. I would suggest between 500 to 1,000 milligrams of magnesium, and then potassium is depleted from our bodies in times of stress, thus upsetting the delicate balance of neurotransmitter communication in our brain. I would suggest 500 milligrams of potassium. 100 milligrams of the B-complex. You need that. Your brain needs that. Your central nervous system needs that. Those are all important. Vitamin C. This is the superstar for Alzheimer's to slow the progression of the disease. I generally suggest a buffered form of vitamin C with quercetin at 500 to 1,000 milligrams 10 times a day, and then see how they tolerate it. Generally, it's better tolerated with a drink, like a smoothie. Vitamin E has been beneficial as an antioxidant. It's very good at high doses because it can help slow the progression of symptoms in individuals with moderately severe Alzheimer's, generally 800 units twice a day. Zinc is very important because almost everyone suffering from dementia is deficient in it, generally 30 milligrams. Acetyl, that's A-C-E-T-Y-L, L-carnitine, C-A-R-N-I-T-I-N-E. This is a very versatile nutrient. It's able to penetrate the blood-brain barrier to stimulate and fortify the brain's nerve cells. And acetyl-L-carnitine is a type of carnitine produced naturally in the brain. For best impact on Alzheimer's symptoms, I recommend increasing the dose to about 2,000 milligrams to 3,000 milligrams, and you take that throughout the day. DMAE, this nutrient found in sardines, is a powerful brain stimulant that increases acetylcholine, a neurotransmitter essential for short-term memory function and concentration. And I've seen Alzheimer's patients with drowsiness, high blood pressure, increased confusion benefit from this. L-glutamine is converted to glutamic acid and increases GABA, a neurotransmitter essential for proper general function. There are two types of glutamine supplements, D-glutamine and L-glutamine. L-glutamine is the form that more closely mimics the glutamine in the body. I recommend 500 milligrams three times a day. Melatonin is the hormone manufactured by the pineal gland in our sleep from the brain. It's involved in the synchronization of the body's hormone secretions and setting daily biorhythms. It stabilizes the sleep cycle that's essential for getting a good night's sleep. Generally 1 milligram. N-acetylcysteine, NAC. This amino acid protects the brain from damage from free radicals by boosting quantities of glutathione, one of the body's most powerful antioxidants, 500 milligrams three times a day. NADH, this is a nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. It's an enzyme that helps improve neurotransmitter function. It's present in all living cells and plays a crucial role in energy production. Generally, I would say 2.5 milligrams twice a day. Phosphatidylserine helps the brain use fuel more efficiently, and it's very important for memory and concentration and cognition. SAMe promotes cell growth and repair and maintains levels of glutathione, a major antioxidant that protects free radicals from free radicals and reduces homocysteine levels. And by the way, Alzheimer's patients have extremely low levels of SAMe in their brains. Also, you could take PPQ, 20 milligrams, the essential fatty acids, about 2,000 milligrams, L-carnitine, about 500 milligrams, threonate, about 150 milligrams, and also curcumin, rhizome extract, about 700 milligrams three times a day, a cytokine suppressor, 300 milligrams, and EGCG from green tea, about 300 milligrams, and black cumin seed oil, 1 teaspoon twice a day, coconut oil, 1 teaspoon twice a day, and probiotics, 5 billion twice a day. Now, there are more things, herbal, homeopathic, other things can be done, but that is a good primer to get started. So at least we're helping the people who have someone in their life who has this terrible condition, and it's a beginning. I'm Gary Knoll. That's our classroom on the air on Alzheimer's. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. Nice to have you with us today. Many people are concerned about what this current president and his administration is capable of doing. The trouble is that they're capable of doing everything wrong, and they're now in the midst of an enormous internal conflict with the very technocrats and the subordinated bureaucrats within all these 17 different intelligence agencies, as well as the military-industrial complex's Pentagon and Defense Department, who profit from no questions asked. And as a result, they're feeding off a $1.5 trillion annual budget when all's in. It's not just the $677 billion the Pentagon gets, it's all the other agencies. There are 200,000 different corporations and contractors who are a part of this system. They had no problem with Obama. They had no problem with Clinton in the first White House, or Bush or Reagan. They have a big problem with Trump, in part because they don't know what to expect from him. If he decides not to engage in Russia and saber-rattling and a new Cold War and not to allow the attack on Iran, then he is not their friend. They profit from a warlike mindset. And this brings me to the idea that we are in Orwell's 1984. And Professor Henry Giroux has stated it succinctly and accurately. We are all now victims unless we stand up and do something. In Trump's immigration order, and that's something that's in the news now, it's meant to carve out a space for the dictates of white supremacists, a space in which those considered flawed, who would that be? Well, you're racially and religiously defective, will be subjected to terminal exclusion and exile. This war on the other is part of a larger obsession which combines a purification ritual with the heightened, if not hysterical, demands of the national security state. But maybe I'm wrong. Every night for the last several months, when available, when I have a TV or internet I can actually access, I want to know what are they talking about. And almost uniformly, the only people coming forth are those who believe that the enemies are real and that we should be arming or fighting them. And this includes China and Russia. We should be enemies of them, and Iran, and many other regimes around the world. You do not hear those who are truly progressive, instead you hear corporate liberals coming forth to make these statements. These are obsessed people, and they are hysterical, and they demand that we do more. Well, under Trump's regime of hatred and the cruelty and misery of massive exploitation associated with neoliberal capitalism merges with a spectacle of exclusion and a politics of disposability that echoes those totalitarian regimes of the 1930s that gave birth to the unimaginable horrors and intolerable acts of mass violence. Racial cleansing based on generalized notions of identity echo the sordid principles of earlier policies of extermination that we saw in the past. This is not to suggest that Trump's immigration policies have risen to that standard of violence as much as to suggest that it contains elements of past totalitarianism that heralds as a possible model for the future. So what I'm arguing is that this form of radical exclusion based upon the denigration of Islam as a closed and timeless culture marks a terrifying entry into the political experience that suggests that older elements of totalitarianism are crystallizing into new forms. The malleability of truth has made it easier for governments, including the Trump administration, to wage an ongoing and ruthless assault on the immigrants and the social state and workers and unions and higher education, or at least public education, and students without thought of their debt, peonage, and poor minorities, and any vestige of the social contract. The principles of casino capitalism, a permanent war culture, the militarization of everyday life, and if you doubt me, just ask how many SWAT team raids were there last year? Over 80,000. How many of those were because someone had simply failed because of how poor they were to pay their bills? It's the majority. So we're taking fully armed individuals, crashing into their doors through straight routines. It never alters. They never just go up and knock on a door. They always assume that they're at risk and they're the ones who are completely armored. They have all the weapons. They have all the bulletproof vests and body protection. They burst in. They'll shoot your dog. They'll shoot you because you owe a parking ticket that wasn't paid. Well, they also profit from that. When was the last time this president said no more? Asset forfeiture. When did he write an executive order saying $4 billion a year stolen from the American public for people who committed no crime, were not cited for a crime, is wrong? There's no executive order for that. Even looking at the home foreclosure, the eviction rate in the United States, which is increasing again. It's like Fukushima. Once it's out of the news, we forget about it. But ask him about Fukushima. What exactly is happening at Fukushima, Mr. President? He would look at you cluelessly. He would not understand. It's still going on. It's terrible. We need to do something. He, again, would still not understand because it's not one of his talking points, but it's still there. Mr. President, what about all the people who are losing their homes? You have the right by executive order to put a moratorium on that so that the public, the Congress that you control now, could free these people from the burden and the fear and the stress and anxiety of losing their homes. There's about 4 people per home, 7 million homes, 28 million people. That's a lot of people not to care about. Many of those people voted for you thinking that you were the answer. And yet you have not addressed their needs at all. To the contrary, you put a person in charge of the housing in the United States who's not doesn't have 1 hour of experience in the field. He was simply Ben Carson. He was simply one of the individuals you were running against. For example, the Guardian wrote an article, and they're looking at soaring rents and low wages, and they've hit the poorest families in America hard. And Harvard sociologist Professor Matthew Desmond introduced an extract from his heartbreaking book about the crisis. No Place Like Home, America's Eviction Epidemic. Did you know, and I'll quote The Guardian, even in the most desolate areas of American cities, evictions used to be rare enough to draw crowds. Eviction riots erupted during the Depression, even though the number of poor families who faced eviction each year was a fraction of what it is today. A New York Times account of community resistance to the eviction of three Bronx families in February 1932 observed, quote, probably because of the cold, the crowd numbered only 1,000. So only 1,000 people showed up to help three Bronx families keep from being evicted? You haven't had 1,000 people show up in the last 10 years to millions of evictions. Sometimes neighborhoods are such that neighbors will confront the marshals. They did then. They don't do it now. In fact, they would sit on the evicted family's furniture to prevent its removal or moving the family back in despite the judge's orders. These days, there are sheriff squads whose full-time job is to carry out evictions and foreclosure orders. There are moving companies specializing in evictions. There are crews working all day, every day. There are hundreds of data mining companies that sell landlords tenant screening reports listing past evictions and court filings. And these days, housing courts swell, forcing commissioners to settle cases in hallways or makeshift offices crammed with old desks and broken filing cabinets, and most tenants don't even show up. Low-income families have grown used to the rumble of moving trucks, the early morning knocks on the door, the belongings lining the curb. In America, families have watched their incomes stagnate or fall, while their housing costs have soared. Median rents have increased more than 70%. Meanwhile, only one in four families who qualify for housing assistance receive it. And in the nation's biggest cities, the waiting list for public housing is not counted in years, but decades. Signing up today for public housing, you may have to wait 20 to 30 years to get one. The typical poor American family does not live in public housing, but receives no government assistance whatsoever. The result today, the majority of poor renting families in America spend more than 50% of their income on housing, and at least one in four spend 70% of every dollar they get to pay their rent just to have a place to sleep. It's estimated that millions of Americans are evicted every year because they can't make rent. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a city of fewer than 105,000 renter households, landlords evict 16,000 adults and children every year. Now, these 16 families evicted through the court system daily. New York City sees 60 marshal evictions every 24 hours. The most recent version of the American Housing Survey asked people, do you think you'll be evicted soon? And 2.8 million people renting said yes. So, Mr. President, what exactly are you doing for these people? These are real people. Many of them were left out. Obama didn't give a damn about these people. The Democrats didn't give a damn. The liberal Democrats didn't give a damn. Clinton, Bush, Reagan, and Obama didn't give a damn. Hillary Clinton doesn't give a damn about anything and never has in her whole life. And all the people, all the different groups who prosper around her prosper and support her simply because she is the person willing to open a door for every form of exploitation, every form of war, every form of murder on the planet. What kind of human beings have we allowed to have such a disproportionate measure of respect in our society? This is Orwellian. So I'm asking you, Mr. President, and the people around you, the collective team of successful people in their own fields, but never one can you show me was successful at helping any of these people. Do these people not count? You attacked Hillary Clinton because she called these people deplorables. Well, what have you done? Why is it that your executive orders are always to help major corporations and not these people? So that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with, today, a whole new world. We're dealing with Orwell. We're dealing with Orwell opening the door for this nightmarish future in which everyday life becomes harsh and an object of state surveillance. And what have you done to stop the surveillance? What have you done to repeal the Patriot Act? What have you done to repeal the National Defense Authorization Act? What have you done to unshackle the American psyche from the constant threat that just by being a normal person and living a normal life, you have no right to assume privacy? We are all under the watchful eye of the government, and you now are the government, sir. You and every single person in your cabinet is the government, and you're getting a little initial hazing. Your agencies that you oversee are now showing that they have illegally listened in on calls from one of your national security advisors who's resigned. They're listening to your calls also. They're listening to your daughter's calls, your son's calls. Does that bother you? Aldous Huxley's Brave New World adds a different and crucial register to the landscape of state oppression, one that is especially relevant in the rise of Donald Trump, a reality TV star and personification of a fatuous celebrity culture. To the highest office in the land, Huxley believed that social control and the propagation of ignorance would be introduced by those in power through the political tools of pleasure and distraction. And for Huxley, freedom and privacy were willingly given up as part of the seductions of a soft authoritarianism, with its vast machinery of manufactured needs and desires and identities. This new mode of persuasion seduced people into chasing commodities, infantilizing them through the mass production of easy, digestible entertainment, disposable goods, and new scientific advances in which any viable sense of agency was undermined. Huxley believed that the conditions for critical thought dissolved into the limited pleasures, instant gratification wrought through the use of technologies and consuming practices that dampened, if not obliterated, the very possibility of thinking itself. If Orwell's dark image is the stuff of government oppression, Huxley's the stuff of distraction, diversions that mark late modern times and are found in the spectacles of extreme violence, of a Super Bowl with Lady Gaga, of the hypermasculine models of entertainment, by every movie that is supposed to be a spectacular movie being driven by special effects, always over the top, everything in excess, nothing understated, no austerity at any level. All the reality shows where every single person in a reality show is a spectacle of conceit, narcissism, stupidity, idiocy, and unfortunately, the worst qualities of human nature, greed, avarice, selfishness, betrayal, and sloth. And those are the most popular shows. Everything is to show how bad we are and how much worse, tuning in this week, you'll find us to be. If you didn't like us last week, you even like us less this week, because our producers and artificial turf, the AstroTurfs of television, have figured out a way to convince us to be even more argumentative, more bitchy, more in your face. So imagine this. If we legalized death in entertainment, do you imagine there wouldn't be a producer out there who would be rushing to get the next show in to show how different ways people could kill each other for the entertainment of those who seem to be lost in this brave new world? That's where we're going. Even to the person who condemns the outsourcing of jobs but does not protest the company that outsourced theirs, but instead supports the company that brought in the product they used to make, which they can now buy in a box store. Who does not protest has no right to complain. And that is where we are today. Huxley is the stuff of distraction, diversions that mark late modern times, and always in the spectacle of violence, representation of the hypermasculine, the infantilization produced by consumer culture, and the power of celebrity culture dressed up in the worship of lifestyle while conferring enormous authority on the likes of celebrities such as the dreadful Kardashians. In a strange but revealing way, popular culture and politics intersected soon after Trump first assumed the presidency. On the side of popular culture, George Orwell's dystopian novel 1984 surged as the number one bestseller on Amazon, both in the United States and Canada. The following two events, one was Kellyanne Conway's Trump's advisor echoing the linguistic inventions of Orwell's Ministry of Health, coining the term alternative facts to justify why Press Secretary Sean Spicer lied in advancing disproven claims about the size of Trump's inaugural crowd. The concept of alternative facts, or more precisely, an outright lie, is simply an updated term of what Orwell called doublethink, in which people blindly accept contradictory ideas or allow truth to be subverted in the name of unquestioned common sense. And there we have it. And that's why we are such a mess today. I'm Gary Nall. Let's now go over and say hello to standing by. Well, we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some the best and worst of our modern religions. Please stay with us.
How long can I go on amusing?
I'd like to welcome all of you. In just a few minutes, we're going to go over and have a very interesting discussion with Richard Gell, one of our scholars in residence, on the best and worst of religions to try to get a perspective on them. But before then, we want to offer you a special package. We haven't offered this before. All the funds will go to support the Progressive Radio Network, the number one progressive radio network in the world, I might mention. Here's what we're giving you. For only $51.99, it's regularly $87. It's a big saving. It's called the Personal Care Package. Now, what's in it? Well, you're getting a hair care special. Many of the ingredients, botanicals and antioxidants, meant to stimulate the scalp and increase blood flow circulation. Wonderful smell to it. Best thing in the world you can put on your scalp to wash your hair is the shampoo. It's a big 16-ounce size. It's for all types of hair, whether normal, oily, dry, straight, or curly, or wavy, or chemically treated. And you use the natural shampoo, you massage your scalp for about 3 minutes, and then rinse it. Then you add the natural hair care conditioner, also 16-ounce. It's a natural multi-purpose conditioner designed by me to repair and nourish your hair with botanical extracts, minerals, proteins, and antioxidants. It adds moisture and luster by delivering rich emollients and helping balance sebum production. So you're getting a shampoo and a conditioner, but you're also getting a mouthwash. We should all always, before we eat or drink anything in the morning, we should gargle for about 60 seconds, spit it out, and then scrape our tongue gently with a tongue cleaner. That means that the bacteria that build up overnight in our mouth, all that is going down the sink and not in our belly when we drink a beverage or eat something. People don't realize that. But my mouthwash is different. It's the best thing you could do for oral health. It's called Fresh Breath Mouthwash. It's loaded with cleansing ingredients to help eliminate harmful bacteria and promote sweet-smelling breath. And this product is free of saccharin, fluoride, or other artificial flavors. And finally, we have the Clean Teeth toothpaste. Wonderful mint flavor. Features whitening power of clove oil and tea tree oil and myrrh extract and other natural ingredients. And it's without fluoride, saccharin, or artificial sweeteners. And just to give you an idea of the clean breath, you're getting in here the cherry essence, you're getting natural glycerin, you're getting a hydrogen peroxide, potassium, peppermint oil, olive leaf oil, clove oil, tea tree oil, echinacea, aloe vera, and golden seal. There's just nothing like this mouthwash. And so you take that mouthwash, and then we also have our clean teeth, where you're getting, again, all of the best ingredients to whiten the teeth naturally, and everything from clove oil and tea tree oil, also wintergreen and myrrh and lavender extract and marigold and basil extract and nutmeg extract and calcium carbonate, that's your baking soda, and menthol, and so in a vegetable base, glycerin and fresh mint. And if you doubt how good this is, try your mouthwash and see how long your breath stays fresh, and then try my mouthwash and see how long it stays fresh and clean and healthy. So you're going to call a number, and our engineers are going to give me that number in a moment, and you're going to order this for $51.99. It's called, so you can call it right, Personal Care Package. So it's the Personal Care Package, and the number is 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. This is the ultimate personal care package. Shampoo, conditioner, mouthwash, and toothpaste. And all made from the highest quality ingredients. I invented all four of these myself. So enjoy them at a great discount. Call 877-627-5065. Richard Gale, nice to have you with us today, Richard.
Yes, good afternoon, Gary.
Richard, there's a lot of confusion because there's a lot of politics, there's a lot of ideologies, there's a lot of misinformation. So let's do this. Explain the best and the worst, that which can enhance our well-being and respect for life and love, and that which also can be interpreted or used as an excuse to represent the worst of human nature in Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. The forum is yours.
Okay, Gary. I think perhaps the greatest misunderstanding in the West is this term Sharia. And I like to think of Sharia, and you can compare this particularly with Judaism, to think of it as like Russian dolls or the Chinese boxes or the nested eggs. In each of the major religions, you have a core group of teachings that are recognized by the believers of those religions as being divinely revealed or revealed texts. And then you have, you kind of go out from the core and you end up with eventually with jurisprudence. And that's certainly the case with Sharia in Islam. So the Quran, of course, is the core teaching for every Muslim. And if there are questions on moral behavior or ethics or how to deal with a certain situation or conflict that arises in life, and if you can't find it in the Quran, then they turn to another body of work called the Sunnah. And the Sunnah is what is are all the hadith. Now, hadith means are just sayings and actions that Muhammad's followers observed or heard during the course of his life, and those were collected. So if you can't find an answer in the Quran, you turn to the Sunnah or the Hadith, and you try to find if there's something we can find here that Muhammad did or didn't do to be able to deal with the situations, for example, and the common one that where Islam gets criticized so much for is on women's rights and the treatment of women. Then you have Sharia. So Sharia is not found in the Quran, per se. It's not found neither in the Sunnah. It's the collection afterwards. And I think that one of the problems of religious studies in general, when you're dealing with any kind of a group of texts or scriptures that are considered to be divinely revealed, is their great ambiguity. Somebody kind of once noted that in the religions of the Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, a Marxist or a Wall Street capitalist, a tyrant, a dictator, or a Democrat, a terrorist, or a conscientious objector, or a peacemaker, or somebody upholds the patriarchy, or a feminist, they can all find passages in the Quran in particular to support their cause. After the Sharia, you have what is called fiqh. Fiqh only means jurisprudence. And fiqh, there are four schools, and these go way back to shortly after Muhammad's time, 8th, 9th century. And these are the ones that lay down the rules. Like you know, a woman's not allowed to drive a car in Saudi Arabia, or how many wives are permitted, or how young can a girl be before she could be wedded. That's these different schools' interpretations, and these are all culturally derived. So one of the smallest ones of these schools of fiqh would be Wahhabism. All right, Wahhabism goes back to a man named Hannibal back in the 9th century, and it was a very, very literal interpretation of the teachings. And the best example you can find in Christianity for this would be John Calvin, who was the founder of the Reformed Church in the 1500s. And he was once even one of the residents of Geneva, Switzerland at the time, had called him the cruel and unopposed dictator of Geneva. He was somebody who wanted to enforce the Old Testament capital punishments literally. Anybody who was accused of heresy would be executed. And he perceived only his church and his interpretation of the Bible as being the true one. All other Christianities at the time throughout the reformational period of Europe were all regarded as heresies. Women at that time, there was a fashion with women wearing their hair higher. Well, you would be punished and put in prison if you were found in Geneva wearing your hair higher. If you were caught masturbating, it would be death by drowning. He had his stepdaughter and his son-in-law were executed for adultery. A child was beheaded for striking his parents, which is, you go back in the books of Deuteronomy, I believe it's Deuteronomy or maybe Ecclesiastes, in the Old Testament, where you have all these very repressive, oppressive laws. One resident of Geneva even wrote that if Christ had visited Geneva, the city at that time, he would have been crucified and burned alive for heresy. Where is Calvinism today? Well, your Baptist churches, Presbyterian, the Reformed Church, the United Church of Christ, those are all Baptist-based Protestant denominations in this country today. So even here we have what we criticize ISIS for, or Wahhabism for its interpretation of Sharia and its kind of very literal regressive interpretation of the Quran. Those same elements are within the Christian and Judaic traditions as well. Did you want to kind of focus a little bit more on just the treatment of women? Is that
yes? Yes. Yeah,
with the treatment of women. Again, there is just so much ambiguity, and for the most part, I found that in the Quran itself, some of the better things we could say, because there are women Muslim women who would argue that there is a great deal of equity in Islam between men and women. There's a quote that from the Quran from one of the surahs that for women there are rights over men similar to those that men have over women. Again, that could be interpreted in many, many different ways, but there's a quote that advocates that there is this equality between men and women. There's another one for men, Muslim men and women, for believing men and women, for devout men and women, for true men and women who are patient and constant, for men and women who humble themselves, for men and women who give in charity, for men and women who fast, for men and women who guard their chastity, and for men and women who engage much in the praise of God. For them, God has prepared a great reward. There's nothing here that says the men are going to be, rewarded better than a woman or a woman better than a man. There is another quote from the Quran that your wives or women are your garment, and you, speaking to the men, are a garment for men, for them. Again, these are all kind of quotes that can be interpreted as being considerable equality. On the other hand, that you have the negative ones. You have from one of the hadith concerning LGBT rights, where from Imam Ali, when statement where Allah curses those men who make themselves resemble women and or those women who make themselves resemble men. You do have in the surahs where older men can marry prepubescent girls. This quote, in fact, in Khomeini during the Iranian Revolution, when Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, they lowered the marrying age of girls to 9, okay, because it was believed that Muhammad was betrothed to a young girl who was 6 named Aisha, but later the marriage was consummated when she was 9 years old. Since then, Iran has increased their age, I think, to 16 or 17 now. Marital abuse. You don't find that in the Quran, but you find it in the stories, the hadith. As I said, that's the second most important source to go for laws and jurisprudence. I might also remark just concerning Aisha, Muhammad's wife, who's one of his youngest wives. She was a commander. She was a military commander riding on the camelback with the troops, engaging in the battles. She was a scholar. There is a book. It's a volume of books. There's 14 volumes. Only the first one was translated into English of a scholar. It's just all about Muslim women who were scholars. They were taught in the mosques. They dealt with legal issues. They were oversaw divorces, the distribution of property after divorces, child custody. This is a 14 volume series of books. Unfortunately, these are the early days of Islam, and that, you know, over the centuries, that's the patriarchal interpretations came to the forefront, and that feminine tradition that you found in early Islam just has kind of been pushed aside into the background.
Richard, we're out of time now, but we will continue this discussion on our next program to go a little further in depth in this to get people an understanding of what we're really dealing with. We're dealing with people who had different power at different times who decided to make new interpretations of old texts to suit their own ideological or political or personal views. And if it was mainly patriarchal, then it became more male-based. And so when you're looking at how it is practiced today, you do not understand or appreciate how many filters it's gone through. So let's continue this discussion on an upcoming program, all right?
Very good.
A lot more to go. Richard Gale is my guest. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.